Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/chapters. There you'll find over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. On this episode of Chapters. So you knew your birthday was on July 12th.
Oh, I knew it was on July 12th.
But it was just never celebrated on that day.
Never celebrated on July 12th.
So when you read this book, did you go to your mother and say, hey, I figured it out?
No.
Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today my guest is Joe Horahan. Joe is an attorney with 4 decades of legal experience. He's a native of Hartford, Connecticut, where he attended Trinity College and the UConn School of Law. Joe describes growing up the child of immigrants in a Catholic household with a mother who hoped he'd become a priest, and shares how reading educated him about his own culture and set him on a different path from his parents. This is Chapters. So maybe we can start and you can tell me your earliest memories of reading.
That's a tough one. It's probably a home experience, being read to by my mother and father, mm-hmm. each at different times. And then it's...
Maybe you could pull a little bit closer.
Then it's probably either one of two things, comic books or prayer books. In our household at that time, it probably had something to do with prayer books.
So you grew up Catholic?
Grew up Catholic. Both parents were immigrants. My father from Canada and my mother from Ireland. Hmm. Neither ever finished grammar school. But they were intelligent people, and they did learn to read, and they were self-educated to some extent, and kept up reading. They weren't. There was always newspapers, magazines in the household.
Hmm. So when you were younger, they read to you, and do you remember this being a lot of religious books, or was it children's books, or what were they reading you?
There were some children's books. I finally probably remember Walt Disney comic books, Donald Duck, those types of things that they would have started reading. Comic books were very prevalent back then in the late 40s, early 50s.
So what kind of comic books were you reading?
There would have been action books. You know, a Superman comes to mind. They had cowboy books. I think one was a Red Rider. And Donald Duck had, you know, several different, Scrooge McDuck, and they'd have several of these. And they would come out every month, and you would look for them in the local pharmacy and pass them around, and everybody kind of read them.
So your parents didn't have any qualms about you reading comic books?
No. I think they were happy that I was reading. Never really had any censorship and that I can think of as far as what I read.
So you said before that you remember reading comic books and prayer books together, sort of. So how did that figure in when you were growing up?
Well, it probably had a lot to do with the... my mother was went to Mass every morning, and she would have gotten me at a very early age some type of missal to follow it.
Because this was this when it was still in Latin?
It would have been when it was still in Latin.
Okay.
But believe you yes, you would have the Latin and the English, but it would be more the gospel and epistle readings that I remember. That you'd get a missal and you could look those up and find them if you were so inclined. There was like a daily, program they had that they set each year. So you could have a fairly thick missal. And I remember doing that and reading some of those and being a little bit intrigued with the epistles because you didn't hear them that often. And they were, especially when we went to the Old Testament. So I remember that part of it. And then that just developed through the, you know, the Catholic education brainwashes you in with their literature. And my mother would have reinforced that. She was very Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, we had the Reader's Digest, we had the Catholic Digest.
Oh.
Oh, yes. That was a book that was similar type of short stories or short little articles. And then the Catholic Transcript. I would say that although those are the earliest, and that's what I emphasize, that I would quickly have gotten away from the religious aspect of it.
Oh, so what inspired that? You just didn't?
I think it was more, it wasn't a more a dislike. It's just that, you know, when you're 6, 7, 8 years old, you know, you don't want to spend a lot of time with hellfire and damnation.
Exactly.
I was always very active in sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember getting books from the Campfield Avenue branch of the Hartford Public Library, and where I'd be interested in two areas. One, I would go in and get the history textbooks, besides the one I had at school, and I would be reading those just because I enjoyed the history. And as a boy, particularly the war aspects of it. And the other would have been a series of baseball books. I still remember the author, a fellow by the name of Dwayne Decker, I believe was the name. And he wrote books that covered, like, each baseball position. They were novels. Probably not terribly well written, and you know, looking back on it, you could always count on the good guys winning in some fashion at the end of the game. But there was, you know, one fellow was Goodfield, no hit, and then there was a catcher from Double A, and I remember the Goodfield, no hit. The guy's name was Johnny Madigan, and the first baseman was a Stretch Stuckey. So I mean, this is a
great
series.
Names.
So that was another thing that I got very involved in reading were these, what I would call teenage athletic adventures, primarily baseball, but covering other sports.
And was that just because you liked playing baseball? Were you also a baseball fan?
I was a baseball fan, very much so. I would get a sport magazine, which I think came out every month, and read articles in that as well. We didn't have a lot of real books around the house, but I remember the magazines being there, and the library was available.
And when you were reading, is your reading life even then something that is kind of just for you, or was it something that you talked about with other people?
It was really, as I look back on it, very personal, I think. You might discuss with one of your playmates, you know, that you had read this baseball book. Again, though, I can't really think that there were that many others that would have been that interested. I had one friend, Jim Belfiore, that we probably shared a lot of thoughts about those types of books, and would recommend something like that to each other, and it did that later in life as well. But you know, it was a very mixed neighborhood growing up in, and you would have people that were, I won't say barely literate, but probably read nothing more than what they absolutely had to. So, you know, it wasn't much sense in talking about books.
So people in your neighborhood were mostly immigrants, or?
I would say mostly immigrants, heavily Irish, heavily Italian, with some Polish mixed in, and periodically some others. But it was all a very, probably classified as lower middle class, white neighborhood, a sprinkling of college educated people, but not a lot. Unique in that everybody was pretty much the same. You didn't have a lot of wealthy people, or if they did, they didn't show it, and you didn't have a lot of extreme poverty. A very narrow band.
What was the first book that you remember thinking, this book really speaks to me, and it had a big impression on you?
Well, again, that baseball series, that Goodfield No Hit, was probably the first one that I remember the name
I love
of
that
now.
Title.
So, I mean, that would have had some bearing on it. As far as books making an impression, one thing I remember, and this would have been in my freshman year in high school, and it was a book called The Scarlet Pimpernel. that might have been the first book that got me interested in broadening horizons from just reading sports stories and getting into a wider variety of maybe adventure stories of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, it had probably been mostly biographical material they had at the school library or sports stories on my own.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I always remember, when we went to grammar school, we had 40 kids in a class. And there were three classes for each grade.
Did you go to Catholic school or public school?
I went to Catholic grammar school.
Okay.
And there was no attempt whatsoever to in any way classify the students based upon ability. So you basically had 120 students in each grade, and they were into three different classrooms. That was it, broken down, just by numbers. And as a result of that, if you were of the more highly literate, you would get very bored in class. I always say by the time the last kid in the class learned the eight Beatitudes, I was climbing the wall.
So you would just have to go up one by one and recite the Beatitudes.
There was a lot of rote things, and then it was all primarily nuns. I think of the 24 teachers, 21 were nuns. And maybe not imaginative. But they would try to teach, and by if someone took a lot longer to learn something, you were supposed to more or less work on your own. And I became somewhat of a disciplinary problem for certain nuns because they would expect me to do a particular thing over and over again. Then as I got to about fourth or fifth grade, and I think the first one that I remember was, ironically, a woman whom a school was named for, Eleanor B. Kennelly. Hmm. She was my fourth grade teacher. She was one of the three lay teachers. And she took the approach that if you finished what your work was, you can go read anything you want. And that was a savior for me because that was fine. And I believe she'd even allow you to bring in a book of your own. So that turned me from a disruptive class person into someone that was, you know, I do the work and then just go over. I was very happy reading, always enjoyed reading.
Hmm.
So that was kind of a change that I remember. And I did have a reversion to another nun the following year who went back to the old fashion, I think in fifth grade, and I became more of a problem then. I think I.
So what were you doing when you were a problem?
Well, I would blow my nose. You know,
what?
I would blow my nose, make a lot of noise by blowing it, which created a problem. Everybody would laugh. And it was very difficult for them to discipline you because it's a natural function. But
So what would they do to discipline you?
Well, you might make you stay in a corner, stay after school. You know, you'd be talking, you'd be passing notes. I mean, you would just try what you could as a kid. You know?
Yeah.
Looking back on it, I think it was boredom.
Yeah.
But then once you got to anything that was more challenging, that went away.
Hmm.
So I think it was just one after that fourth grade that took that view. And then they would send you down sometimes to the library, which was great. You could go down there and you'd have, to me it was like a bonanza. You could go in and pick a book and read anything you want, which primarily biographies, but it was still interesting.
Yeah. So when you get to high school and you read The Scarlet Pimpernel, like, why did that matter to you?
It broadened my horizon, saying, well, gee, you don't have to just read sports books or magazines. You can enjoy a novel that was set in it was just a totally different setting and something that I enjoyed that I had not opened my eyes to.
Hmm.
I remember shortly after that, Alexandre Dumas, everybody remembers the Three Musketeers. What few people realize is that he actually wrote, that was the first of a series.
Hmm.
And I can remember, I think I was a sophomore in high school, finishing the Three Musketeers, finding out that he had written these other three books, and going to the main branch of the library and checking them out and reading them one at a time thereafter. Yeah, I was blessed in a sense that I was a good student and could do the other work very quickly. So I was always, even in high school, I had study halls where I'd end up reading on my own. That was my that's what I'd fall back on.
Yeah.
And I probably persisted throughout life. Most of these were not assignments. These were things that I just read on my own.
And by that point, when you're in high school, you're past where your parents had gone in terms of their education, right?
Yes, yes. I think that they were always supportive, but it was, yeah, you look back on it, you don't realize it, but yes, it was from a literary point of view, they really did not have much of a background. They made things available, but it would be things would be beyond their, something they would never have read, for instance.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, with that in mind, when you're in high school and you're thinking, are you thinking about going to college, or are your parents sort of trying to influence you to think about what you might want to do with your life? And are books playing any role in that process at all?
I think books, it was kind of a natural progression. I don't know how to really put it. A lot was always expected. But
were you the oldest?
I was the second.
Okay.
The second. I always think the second, especially in an Irish family, is the one that fulfills the stability role. And I've seen many situations where that comes to pass. My brother was very bright, but he was not inclined to be studious. And he was always looking for an angle. And he was not involved either in sports nor reading.
Hmm.
He was more mechanically oriented. I did have teachers that were particularly influential in high school. One of them, whom I remain friends with today, was Neil Moylan.
Hmm.
Now, I had Neil as a ancient history teacher.
Hmm.
And he would have been very helpful in also suggesting books to read. I remember reading, and I had him again when I was a junior in a modern history course, which was not the college curriculum, number one curriculum, but I actually took it as an extra course because I liked history so much. And he got me involved reading Winston Churchill's series of six books, starting with The Gathering Storm
right.
on the Second World War, which were very impressive to me at that age. Funny, I read those about 5 years ago. I reread them with a little differing view.
Oh, can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. When I read them the first time around, I was accepting everything Churchill said as godsend and not really evaluating critically at all the fact that he was anything more than just an historian. His self-interest in these things did not come across to me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I read them the second time, I said, oh, my God. He was a brilliant man, and he had a prodigious memory, and he could cover many, many areas. But he was never, and maybe it was a benefit of having more education, too, realizing that he wasn't always right.
No, but, I mean, he's also the person who said, history will be kind to me, for I intend to write it.
Yes, and he did.
Yes. I reread those books, too, myself just a couple years ago, and I had the same experience where, I mean, you read different accounts of decisions, and it's like, oh, my God. Basically, he's written his own hagiography, but he presents it to you as fact.
Yes. It's, again, if you're a student of history, you think back on these things and realize that history belongs to the victors.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same, too, with even Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Richard III, I guess it is,
Yeah.
Shakespeare was justifying to his audience, the Tudors, their legitimacy. So some of and again, he may or may not have killed his nephews. We don't know that,
right?
But it was behooved Shakespeare to show what the evil man that the Tudors had gotten rid of,
right?
So you, as a youngster, it takes a while to become critical, and probably through your college years, you're still an absorber, and in all your life, I think you still learn to evaluate things as you go through it. But certainly in high school, you're very much just taking things in.
Right, and I imagine, too, when you were reading it then, when you're reading a history of World War II, for example, you're living amongst men who have fought in the war.
Yes, you identified very closely with it, and you knew people that had been served in the war, had been prisoners of war, so you felt it as a very personal thing.
Right.
During that time, too, we were very, very close to the Korean War.
Mm.
So there were certain things there that you learned about for the first time. And another, it's not really literary, but it was a movie, was the Joe McCarthy exposure, too. I think that was a...
That's a movie you saw then or a movie you saw recently?
I saw that. I actually didn't see it till I was in law school, but I know McCarthy in the Red Scare, looking back on that, was a Point of Honor, by the way, is the name of the movie.
Right.
Point of Order, maybe it is. But it reminded me of growing up, where even in the Catholic grammar school, you'd have air raid drills. There really was a Red Scare that existed, that when you look back on it was certainly overblown at the time.
Mm.
And the anti-communism idea, I mean, if you mentioned anything communist was bad, it was a very much a litmus test, good or bad, and that still exists today. Whereas if you look at communism as a pure philosophy, it really is Christ-like. It's almost Christian. It's the application, and it takes a while to...
But when you're in high school, you're not thinking about, like, oh, I'm going to go read the Communist Manifesto and
no.
think this through. And probably other people aren't doing that in your life. They're just associating communism with
It was almost a negative. But you gradually, and probably, as I say, Neil Moylan as a junior would have been influential in getting you to think outside the box a little bit and question some of these ideas. It started out that way. And I had a very good English department then at Buckley. They had an advanced placement English, and Dorothy Potter ran it. And she would have they combined the junior and senior classes, which was a good thing. So you got into that. And one of the things they do there is you would pick an author and read several of the books, which I found very interesting. I remember doing, then you do a longer-term report on John Hersey, for instance. Robert Conrad was another, read several of the books. And William Faulkner, which I found to be quite interesting. Just picking authors like that and reading four or five of their books, which was a good experience. And I think, again, reading is something, if you do a lot of it, you know, every book builds upon the other.
Go ahead.
Well, as to influential books, this is kind of a very personal thing, and it's kind of ironic because I went to Trinity. But one of the most influential books for me happened to be Leon Uris's book Trinity, and the reason is very, very personal. Growing up as an Irish Catholic, I was born on July 12th. Now, to non-Irish people, that does not mean very much. But to my Athlone-born, strict Catholic mother, July 12th was a day of mourning. It was Orangeman's Day, so no Irish Catholic was going to celebrate anything.
Can you explain what that day is for people who may not know?
Well, it's actually the anniversary of the Battle of the Boyne, which was when William of Orange, where the Orange comes from, came over and defeated... I believe it would have been Charles II, and got rid of the Stuarts in England. 1688, I believe, was the year, and started a new dynasty. And it was very much based upon the fact that the English no longer wanted a Catholic, and it had come out at that point that James II was, in fact, a secret Catholic. So that was a big deal back then. For dynastic reasons, amongst other things. And so this was a battle it became a battle that the Irish Protestants celebrated. They would have marching days in Northern Ireland, 10 days of them. And that was one of the times, even in the 50s and 60s, you would hear about riots because the Orange group insisted upon marching through the Irish sections.
Mm.
So it was a very much a tinderbox type of atmosphere. But because of my having been born on that day, my mother would never, as a child, celebrate my birthday on July 12th. She would move it. Either we were away or there was some reason not to do it. I, as a kid, didn't pay any attention to it. And she'd usually pick August 15th because that was a holy day of obligation. So that was more appropriate in her mind. But we would have the birthday party, but just never on July 12th. And it was when I read the book Trinity that it all came together for me as to why the celebration of anything on July 12th would have been anathema to my mother and why she had done that. So I always remembered. Plus, the book itself was a very good book in capturing what developed in the Irish Protestant, Irish Catholic relationship and how it was almost a sectarian, it became a sectarian thing from above, that the people that the leaders really used it for their own benefit to divide the people and get them fighting with each other.
Hmm.
So the historical part of it too, but it was very personal to me because it brought home.
So you knew your birthday was on July 12th.
Oh, I knew it was on July 12th.
But it was just never celebrated on that day.
Never celebrated on July 12th.
So when you read this book, did you go to your mother and say, hey, I figured it out?
No. it wasn't, never did bring that up with her. She never, and she never mentioned anything about that. In her, anti-English feeling was very subtle. She came from Athlone, which in Ireland was really not a hotbed of IRA activity. They even had a garrison in town, and they said the regular soldiers were very friendly. So there wasn't a lot of animosity vis-a-vis the common people. Of course, she remembers telling about the black and tans. So her feelings were really kept to herself. She never really mentioned that. And I kind of grew away from her, even as a young teenager, in that sense that I didn't follow her path. You know, when I didn't want to become a priest, that was it. I remember that was in eighth grade. They had a scholarship, and I made no bones about it. I was not going to St. Thomas Seminary. I don't care where I finished in the class, I was not going.
We'll return with more chapters after this break. For our chapters listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. If you visit audible.com and sign up for a free 30-day trial, you can download an audiobook for free. Why not check out a favorite of Joe's, Trinity by Leon Uris? To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/chapters. Again, that's audibletrial.com/chapters for your free audiobook. Now let's get back to the show. Did she want you to become a priest?
Oh, yeah. Every Irish mother at that point wanted it, yeah. But, I mean, it was not going to be me. And I think I ended up being second in the class because the other fellow went to St. Thomas Seminary. He lasted there a year.
Of course.
My good friend Jim Belfiore. And if I knew Jim Belfiore, he would be the last person in the world. But it was an honor, and he went for a year. But I said, no, I rebelled at that point.
Well, that's what I'm curious about is, you know, so your education background is starting to become really different from your parents, and your reading life is starting to expand. And I'm wondering if the books that you're reading are informing the way that you're becoming aware of a difference between you and your parents, or differences, you know, thinking about different things, how you think about things, what you want out of life, whatever.
I think that's definitely true. Seems very egotistical, but I always felt, because of the competitive nature, I always assumed, and I don't know why, that I would end up in college somewhere. And I was a good student. I was playing three sports. So I think in the freshman year, I was number one in the class. I ended up graduating third. And it probably could have been second, except the math teacher was so easy. He gave all the advanced placement people A's, and I was a good math student, so it didn't make any difference. And I had very high college board scores, so I knew I was going to go somewhere to school. And being an athlete, and I knew it would have to be a scholarship. Now, And I guess I won't say I disrespected my mother, but she became much less of an influence. And I think that was partially the reading. With my father, I didn't have that problem, although he may have even been less well-read. But what he did is he worked outside throughout his life with younger people. And I think he became very tolerant. I mean, he did not brand anybody because of what their nationality or their color. I mean, again, the language back in the 50s would have been viewed as racist today. But his actual dealings with people were based upon how they treated him or what he knew of them. I remember one instance where we had a TV repairman. We needed a tube in the TV. And he said, well, I got a guy at work. And he went to see the guy, and he happened to be an African-American. We'd call him Black then. And the guy said, well, you know, South End of Hartford, you want me to come down to your house? I said, sure, you can come down to my house. Well, the neighbors mind. He said, I don't care, they mind. Yeah, you're coming to fix my television. You're certainly entitled to do that. So, I mean, he was, and that's something that always stuck in my mind. And he'd have that way both pro and con about people. He was a very big influence, but more, not so much from the reading point of view, but it reinforced probably what I was finding out in the reading. And gradually you learn to think a little independently. And of course, college was it took the grounds and just expanded it geometrically.
So you decided, you went to Trinity College.
I did.
And why did you go there?
Well, that's an interesting. I was looking to go to Yale. My father had an enlarged heart, and he was retired. He was older. So he retired when I was a senior in high school, at 68, 65. So I said, well, maybe I don't want to go that far from home. I had known people who went to Trinity, very close friends like Barry Leghorn, and they were there, and they arranged an interview. It was like on January 10th with the admissions department. And so I went up and met the football coach, Dan Jesse, went to the admissions department. And the early admissions there was closed at that time on January 1st. And the fellow looked at me, and then I started talking. And I said, yeah, my father, he's retired now from the Hartford Electric Light Company. And his eyes lit up. I didn't realize that then they had a scholarship called the Ferguson McGregor Scholarship, which the Hartford Electric Light Company gave to Trinity as a for full tuition, room and board scholarship, with preference to be given to employees. Well, all of a sudden, here he had someone that he wanted to bring in to help the athletic department. I could fit a niche where he didn't have to go. He could use money that he would have been probably normally used for a non-athlete. He now found an athlete that he fit right in there. So it made it easier. So he said to me, look, we'll come to Trinity, get that application, and I'll have you accepted in a week. And that's what happened.
Wow.
So I never really went anywhere else and never applied to another school. I had gone down and looked at Yale. I think I went to a football game there, but I had no real particular tie except, you know, people mention it. It's a live Ivy League school in Connecticut. So I only applied to one school.
What was it like when you went there? Because Trinity is kind of another world in a lot of ways from the world you grew up in.
It is. It's very much another world. When we went there, you had more of a middle class influence, I think. And I had the benefit. I lived a mile and a half from Trinity. But one of my deals with them, and it had somewhat to do with my mother, is that I had to stay on campus, you know, otherwise I'm going somewhere else. And they, because of the scholarship situation, that fit right in with them. They didn't care. And fine, you can come and live on campus, and which I did all 4 years. And it may have been because we had relative success, especially in basketball. Jim Belfour and I had been on this Buckley High School team, which at that time was had reached a lot of notoriety. Because we were second in the state tournament, second in New England. It was the last time they had a New England high school basketball tournament. So we kind of came as two local kids. And I look back on it, we were too ignorant to be intimidated. I mean, we were just brash. kids coming to South End of Hartford. And, you know, that's just the way we acted. And we kind of, I think in some respects, the school didn't know what to make of us. Hmm. And we were decent students and contributed a lot in the sports. Jimmy left there with the athletic, with the basketball record. He was the captain for 2 years. And we both contributed a lot to the school. But it also was a school then that had, as I say, much more of a middle-class influence. That may be partially because of the shrinking of the middle class in total, but also the cost. The cost was not astronomical. If you needed to make $500, you could do that in a summer. No one's going to make, half of the tuition payment. It was only $1,000, I think, my first year was tuition.
Wow.
And I think it less, by the time I left, it was up to like $1,700 or $1,800. But you could make up the difference, presumably, with a summer job. Now, of course, the $70,000, where are you going to get that? So that's just the numbers have just made an influence on Trinity in that regard. And that's sad, but I don't know that it's, anything much that can be done about that. Mm. I mean, the enrollment is what it is. There's a commitment to minority students. There's a commitment to athletics. There's only so much money to go around. So I think the mix has now become much more of an upper class, school for all those open spots. Mm. And that I think is sad, but it's a fact. And it probably goes on with a microcosm of the whole country.
Sure, yeah. So what books did you read when you were at Trinity? What kinds of things were you reading that influenced you?
Well, Dickens. I remember reading Dickens and having John Dando, an English professor, who went through some of the Dickens. He was a real Dickens enthusiast. I remember Bleak House, which is not a very popular Dickens book, but mm-hmm. we read that, and I still quote that sometimes, and even in court, although I don't think most people know what the hell I'm talking about, but I always say, well, we don't want this case to get like Jaundice v. Jaundice.
That's right.
And people look around wondering, what the hell is he talking about? Once in a while, I'll find someone who's been an English major who'll understand what I'm referring to.
Right.
The case that was arguing the fourth reply to the seventh amended motion to dismiss or something, and everybody had gone on for 50 years. No one knew what the hell the case.
There was no money left in the estate to begin with.
Yeah. No one knew what the hell this real case was really about. It was all technical motions.
I always remember that book because it's the first example of a character who spontaneously combusts in that book somewhere.
See, I don't remember that, but I remember Jaundice v. Jaundice.
Were you at Trinity when they had to wear caps? Because you were there when it was all men, right?
It was when we were all men. Caps, you mean like for beanies, freshman week?
Yeah, beanies.
We had beanies for 1 week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was just freshman week, and then you'd have a big to-do at the end of the freshman week with the sophomores. And, that was they used to have I think when we were there, they had this gigantic ball. You had to roll some one way or the other. And, of course, you had the whole freshman class, and there was only a small percentage of the sophomores. And once you accomplished whatever that feat was, the beanies went away.
Oh, okay.
So that was only a short period of time.
Got it.
There were other books. I mean, at Trinity, I would have always... And I remember roommates even talking to me saying, what are you doing reading that for? I said, it's not for class. They said, well, I always enjoyed reading outside of what the class was.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the books I read War and Peace without being required to.
Amazing.
That was probably a summer project. But it was, and I remember the essay at the end of that as making a lot of sense to me. It was a very anti-war essay
mm-hmm.
that Tolstoy had written. Brothers Karamazov was another one that I found interesting. And Anna Karenina. Hmm. It was a period, I guess, when I had read the Russian authors. Particular books. Well, one thing that's kind of interesting that stuck with me, I was thinking of this when you mentioned this, is that I remember going to a reception at for, I don't know, some group of select students at the president's. Albert Jacobs was the president at the time. And he was a well-learned man, also a lawyer. And sitting in his den and looking over at his briefcase, and he had in there every Earl Stanley Gardner book. Earl Stanley Gardner wrote all the Perry Mason books. And a little duck came down to me, and I said, geez, you know, I guess there's nothing wrong with reading pleasure books, Simple Detectives, because here's the president of college. He's got every one of them there.
Huh.
And he's proud of that. And I think that's something that I've always kept up, is I don't read everything for punishment. I read a lot of things just for enjoyment.
Hmm. Do you do that when you go to people's houses? Do you look at their bookshelves?
I have looked at bookshelves. I do look and see what people are reading. And sometimes I'll
ask
them about books. I don't judge them much from what they're reading, no. But I would sometimes be curious as to what they're reading. One of the funny occasions I had is I had this fellow who was not highly educated, but he became a millionaire, some mechanical type of business. And one of the things he did was went out and bought, probably 100 of the world's classics in bound books and put them in his bookcase. And to me, I just couldn't resist saying something to him. Bob, I said, you can't tell me you've read any of those books. Have you read any of those books? He said, well, once in a while I take one down. I said, you're full of shit. Knowing him, he hadn't read any of those. So, I mean, that was then. But I guess that's kind of an old English library. It wasn't that unusual. But
he wanted people to see that he had them.
Yeah, that he had those books. Yeah, that I found laughable. But I do notice what other people read. Maybe sometimes it brings up a topic of conversation.
Mm. Did you know when you were at Trinity that you wanted to be a lawyer?
At some point, it seemed like the natural progression. I went there first as a math major because I had a very high college board score in math. But about halfway through my freshman year, I said, this isn't for me. I can't. The higher math just wasn't something I was interested in pursuing. So I switched over to history. I thought about literature, but history. And it seemed to be the natural progression. Now, I was probably influenced by the fact that that was the Vietnam War era. And my class going into law school was the last class that had a draft exemption through law school.
Hmm. So what year was that?
Graduated in 66 from Trinity.
Okay.
So that was a part of it. The other thing is when I went to law school, and this sounds crazy, but at the University of Connecticut, which was then in West Hartford, I was able to stay at home, and my tuition for the entire year was $300. $300. And it was a good law school. It was drastically underpriced, even at that point. It cost me more for books that year than it did for tuition.
Wow.
And able to stay at home. So it was a very affordable path. And I had always gotten involved in the Perry Mason books. I'd read some of those. I remember reading some Louis Neiser books. Again, he fits the same category as Churchill later in life when I read one of his. And I said, boy, this guy's a real pompous ass talking about how good, this is really how great I am.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it made an impression on me. To Kill a Mockingbird was always a strong book, too.
Yeah.
Harper Lee's book. Mm-hmm. In the movie, too. Learned very early on, too, with some of those, although you'd see the movie, that the books were really more enjoyable.
Hmm.
I can remember even things that, like Ben-Hur, Lew Wallace, I think was a Civil War professor, general, wrote that book. And the book captured more. So I was always, the vivid imagination of myself was better than what they could put on the movies.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I think readers probably share that.
Hmm.
Other books, I remember reading Barbara Tuchman's books, Guns of August, which I thought was very, very thorough and research on the coming of the First World War and how you kind of stumble into a war.
Mm.
And then she's written other books. She wrote one on the 14th century, which I found to be somewhat fascinating, too. believe it or not, I didn't have much of an interest in Irish history until I was either junior or senior at Trinity. I think it was a junior year. And the professor who taught English history at that time was George Cooper. And he was on the Hartford Board of Education. He knew I had come from Buckley. And we were talking about term papers. And he said, why don't you write something about Ireland? I said, okay. And he was a very literate man. And I said, well, you know, I don't know much about the Irish famine. So he spouted off about 10 books just off the top of his head, which I then end up reading and doing a term paper on. And that was probably the first time I really got into the Irish question and the Irish-English relationships. You know, again, I like the statement about Irish history. It's something that the Irish should forget and the English remember. I think the history of British-Irish relationship fits into that category. But I remember doing that famine book and reading the statistics and being utterly horrified and amazed that there was actually, during this time of famine, a large amount of food that was being exported out of Ireland, and yet the people were left starving. Hmm. So that made an impression on me, and I read more as more of a hobby than anything else into Irish history, with in fascination with the, you know, Wolfe Tone, Daniel O'Connell, Michael Collins, of course, is always a favorite, very controversial. We actually had a nephew, I believe, of Eamon de Valera, who grew up in the south end of Hartford. He became a local do-gooder. He became like thought of himself as a disciple of John Kennedy, a fellow by the name of Ned Call, the Revitalization Corps. Ned was kind of a little different, shall we say. But I don't know, was knowing him made me kind of anti-De Valera or whether the history books did, but I found that whole rivalry somewhat fascinating. And the abandonment of the treaty participants by De Valera, that's the way I at least saw it, and I think most Irish historians would. But to be things like that where I, throughout the years, I've always kept up reading, even as it is now. I was probably a multitasker before the word was invented. I mean, I still sit and watch a baseball game in between pitches. I'll be reading a couple of sentences or a paragraph of a book. Mm. I do the same thing watching a football game. Mm. I guess it's just something I always enjoyed doing. Mm. And it had a very big influence in my life. It's something, if I look back on it, that's permeated the entire life. It's something you can do as a youth, you can do at any age. I think everything you read builds upon something else. I use the Churchill books you mentioned as, you know, as we become a little better educated and more critical, you don't accept some of these things at such face value as the author puts in there. You become a little more discerning. I guess that's part of an education.
Well, and it seems like you grew up in the generation, too, that you mentioned that you graduated from Trinity in the 66 and that you were probably in college or high school when John Kennedy was president, and you read To Kill a Mockingbird. There's so much social upheaval in the 60s that maybe your response to it was informed in some way by what you were reading, and that's continued in some way to kind of have a critical stance.
It probably is. I think there's a... we were really the last generation that were much closer to the people who graduated in the 50s. If you took people graduating 3 years, people who graduated from Trinity at the same time I graduated from law school had a totally different view of the world. They were much more activists. Even when they came to Trinity, I can remember, because I actually worked there as a security guard when I was in law school. But I could see a difference in the protests were not being led by the upperclassmen. They were being led by the freshmen and sophomores. And that So we were kind of the last group that were very much, you know, almost Eisenhower-ish. We were laissez-faire. We were worried about beer. Nobody really thought that much about it. I mean, Vietnam was off on the horizon. And all of a sudden, when we graduated, we were all faced with this problem. It was becoming much more of an issue then. I think the loss of John Kennedy was a big factor. I can remember, as they say, you remember where you were when that happened. And then the loss of Robert Kennedy when I was in law school. I think those were two big blows. And, of course, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, I think, were only 6 weeks apart or something crazy in 68. And you can see the upheaval that created in the questioning of the basic structure, which came from the youth. It was a very interesting phenomenon to observe. And I really wasn't as much involved in that. I lived through it, but lived through it much more as an observer. Hmm. I wasn't in the protests. They were all just came right after it. And I was just starting out in a career, so it didn't have much influence. But again, the whole Vietnam, I think in the later, as you really realize what had gone on there, and you read some of these books, the best and the brightest, and the people that were brought in that were so intelligent, the McNamara's and everything else, and just did these crazy things. And I think it's very analogous to what's going on today. I mean, we seem to be forgetting totally some of these things that have gone on. Mm. And of course, this guy in charge now is that's a good question. What's going on there? But I think also back, you see that there was more. There was partisanism, but it did not seem to be quite as isolated from each other. And that's a problem, I think, that comes from left and the right. Mm. The left can be as intolerant as the right. I mean, a real true liberals to me are someone that, you know, disagrees maybe with someone else but recognizes their right to voice that opinion. That seems to have been lost in our liberalism of today. It's not liberalism. It's just that, you know, it, you have to be my way or there's no other way. Well,
and do you find that reading the news or reading up on different issues, does that make you feel not comforted, but, I mean, do you get some kind of positive outcome of reading about what's going on right now, or does it seem to just make you feel even more frustrated with the way things are?
I'm very much again, it comes from being a lawyer. As a lawyer, you get so many times you have to look at situations and say, look, what's practical? What can be done? You know, it's kind of like that AAA motto. You know, you recognize what you can change, what you can't change, and God grant me the wisdom to know the difference. So from that, I think lawyers tend to be very practical, especially in a small practice, and you try to solve problems. So I don't become as much frustrated because I know there's not too much that can be done about it. I become very disappointed that more attention isn't paid probably to history. It doesn't have to be that far back. I'm disappointed, too, that more people aren't really as literate as they should be in this day and age. And what does that actually mean? Well, everything seems to be too technologically oriented. I was always a great believer in a liberal arts education. The cost of education, I think, has driven some of the liberal arts philosophy almost out of the colleges, because you're paying that much money, you expect someone to come out with a ready-made job. Whereas I think the liberal education taught you to think and to be adaptable and to do a great many more things, or at least to be able to evaluate them, rather than being in a narrow discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So that bothers me to some extent, and the intolerance. I think if you're a student of history, you realize things have always been like that. People complain about, certain people don't work that hard. Well, read a book about the Middle Ages. You'll find out there was a there's always a certain group that are taking care of the rest anyway. I mean, this is the human condition. It's one reason communism failed. I mean, everybody's not going to work the same way. Everybody's not going to be motivated the same. So I think the reading and broadens your scope and allows you to accept some of these things. So actually, I think rather than being frustrated, I think the reading helps you tolerate, maybe is a better word, or at least recognize that these things, the details may change, but the human condition hasn't changed all that much. Hmm. And that's one reason why even the Greek tragedies, but in particular Shakespeare, can still be so topical, because the human emotions are still there.
Hmm.
And now, unfortunately, and I worry about some of the younger generation that are too attracted to the technological aspects of things. And I think that leads to a shorter attention span. I mean, if you can see a movie in 2 hours, why spend 2 days reading a book? Well, you get a better feeling for the book, you know, the character development, and not every book, but I mean, it gives you, I think you learn much more from the book. You forget the movie, most of them within an hour or two. You may remember a scene or two. You don't remember the things, and they don't get into your subconscious.
Mm. Mm.
You don't really feel like you've met the people.
Yeah.
You see what they've done rather than how they think and why. So, I mean, that's... And I still read today, and I try to do a variety of reading. It has become much more reading for pleasure. A lot of Richard Patterson or Reacher books, so Lee Child's, things of that nature I gravitate towards. Mm. Surprisingly, not that many legal books. Law thrillers. I prefer the detective, quite honestly,
yeah,
to the lawyers. I think as a lawyer, you're always questioning or saying, "Well, that doesn't. You can't really do this." Like L.A. Law, Law and Order. I prefer the police aspects of that much better than the courtroom ones, because you can't do that in the courtroom. Excuse me.
Because you can watch that and see the mistakes or things that won't happen.
It's too Hollywoodized, the courtroom aspect of it. Hmm. The police work probably is also, but I enjoy it more.
Fair enough. So by way of closing, what's a book that you'd recommend to our listeners right now?
Boy, a book you recommend. Hit me there. I didn't think of any. I did just read a John Grisham book. And I'm trying to remember the name of it. But it's set in Ada, Oklahoma. And for a Grisham book, it is not a fiction.
Hmm.
It's a story of a Kill Mockingbird, but without the racial overtones. But it's a man who was convicted, put on life on death row, and then ultimately with DNA acquitted. I found that a very interesting book.
Awesome.
Wish I could remember the name of it for you, but that's enough of a description anyway.
I'll look it up. Don't worry.
All right.
I'll figure it out. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I so appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Amy. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our guest Joe for sharing his story with us. I'd also like to thank our producer Taylor for all of her help. You can find us on Twitter at ChaptersPod. You can find me at MaryMahoney123 and Taylor at MJTThePhD. You can find us on Instagram at ChaptersPod. There you'll find shelfies submitted by our guests. Follow our page on Facebook and you can get updates on the show and join conversations about each episode with other listeners. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really helps listeners find our show. Thanks for listening.